It's not that easy. No, it's not easy even to understand what the question is. I mean, I think I have a sense of what you mean, but not. The question is going to come later is there, when it comes to yardas, is there one absolutely correct way, and all the ways are invalid? Except you can have arguments because people can disagree as to what the correct approach is.
Correct.
Okay, but that there is a correct approach, is that something that everybody agrees upon? But there's one derech, there's one correct approach to the understanding of yardas, to the philosophy of yardas, so to speak. Is this such a thing? Or no? The Torah is so broad enough to accommodate many different approaches, and we can have more of a subjective type of phenomenon where, you know, an approach can be your approach, this is my approach, and one can't say that this is the correct one and that's the incorrect one, able to able, so to speak. In fact, that's the way Lenny formulated the question yesterday. Isn't there an expression in Chazal that says able to able, Bivyal can claim? They're both the words of the living God, which seems to imply that both are equally valid. Okay? That's the question. I mean, admittedly, they were stating it in very general types of terms, you know, so. Well, this is the kind of question like, what do you mean? You know, be more specific. So on and so forth. But let me just hear some reactions to that. There's different kind of areas. There's certain areas in life where everybody recognizes that every normal person recognizes that it's subjective. A person enjoys skiing, and he, it's a very important element in his life. So, I'll say, for me, this is, you know, does it for me. This is what makes life worthwhile. But I don't really believe that this is what man was created for, and whoever doesn't partake of skiing is not. But most, you know, that's clearly the kind of thing which has a subjective element to it. But then, when you're getting into other areas usually where it's an area of belief, like religion, that's why there's religious. Before there's religious hatred, and why is there so much warfare revolving around religion, religious disputes? If people didn't believe there's an absolute truth, you don't know. Why do all religions fight against each other? I'm not talking within one religion. Within Judaism against Christianity and Islam, and within Christianity there's a million different denominations. And why is there such a thing as religious war if at least in their own minds they have the idea that this is the absolute truth? So therefore the other religion is a threat to them. Because the fact that they believe in something different as the absolute truth makes them insecure that maybe they have the absolute truth. But if, to begin with, we're all maintaining that there is no such thing as an absolute truth, and it's just objective truth, so what are you fighting about? There's nothing to fight about.
No,
you're trying to impose your subjective truth on him, or he already has subjective truth, he doesn't need your subjective truth. But the truth of the matter is that within Judaism too, it seems to me, and even within Orthodoxy, well, that's the whole reason why is there a battle against Orthodox versus conservatives? Because we believe that there's an absolute truth, and that the conservatives are compromising that absolute truth. Now, within Orthodoxy itself, it seems to me, when you're talking about when people have gotten together and formulated a specific philosophy, and they said, let's take Hasidus as an illustration, because that seems to me a group of people that are very have a specific shita, specific position, right, to which they adhere, and that means a lot to them. I don't think that they're mellow about it. No. I think the typical chassid, Satma chassid, believes that's it. Chassidus, his brand of chassidus. Unless the other brand partakes, in other words, they share certain things in common. I don't know how broad the principles are, but you know, when you go beyond the boundary line and you're outside of what they would regard as true Hasidus. Yeah, because with the Hasidus you have wars too. You have the war of the Lubavitch against the Chassidus.
Absolutely.
And in other words, it seems to me, my experience, that the Lubavitch Chassid believes that that's the ultimate form. And that he doesn't say for me. That's perhaps what he says in polite discussion among other people. Because he doesn't want to come off expressing his true view. But so you see, it seems that, especially when there's this idea of like missionizing. In other words, to win other people over, what we call proselytizing, usually that's term is used, you know, to win over people from different religions. I don't mean disparagingly, but it's a It's that type of a, it's an ideological movement which seeks to win over converts, so to speak. So therefore, it's because, you know, they really believe that this is the ultimate truth. You know, I say to Lubavitch because they've been clearly the most public in that respect. I mean, not just to try and win over the Jews, but win over the whole world over their ideas. I mean, they've gone public, put newspapers, put ads in newspapers and so on and so forth to try and win over. Like, they clearly believe that this is it. That's exactly what we're focusing on. Is it possible to say that this is the right way, and then there's a different way, and that way is also the right way? Is that possible?
Absolutely.
Now, the thing is like this, the truth of the matter is that there are really two areas. There are certain areas where, you know, you work out a method, right? And your position about that, you believe this is true, and you view others as being false. Then there are areas where you work out a method, and you view yours as being true, but then you recognize other methods, and you regard them as being true also, which seems to be, that seems to be a little bit more difficult, but let's see if we can be more specific about it. Like what is it that determines, you know, when you say that that's it, that it's exclusive? That your view is true, the other one has to be false. You can't get any acknowledgement to it. You all agree on that, I mean. You all agree that Orthodox Judaism is correct, conservative Judaism, you don't say it's correct for conservative, and Orthodox is right for Orthodox, you're saying Orthodox is correct. So, you know, well, let's face it, you can't ignore that. How come over there, why don't you say the same thing? Well, why do you draw the line? And say there are many approaches, that's why a conservative or a reform guy will say to you, there's many approaches to God, this is my approach. So why you, who seem to be liberal and accept that idea in a certain realm, why do you limit it? And the burden is going to be on you if that's the case. It says, well, what's wrong with his approach to God? What's wrong with the reform guy's approach to God? The idea of like machlokes. You see, the whole Torah is permeated with machlokes. Right? I mean, you can't eliminate. Machlokes is part of the essence of Torah. You can find it in the Torah itself. Yeah, we'll do some motion and iron, we'll find certain places of what we would call machlokes. Difference of opinion, even the benos tzalokha, and the issue of nachla. Right. I don't know if you want to call it truly a machlokes, but they maintain one position in it. And Moshe said it's a possibility, he wasn't sure. So he asked God, in Luvieshma. And God gave the answer, saying that they were correct. So the fact that Moshe had to ask, presupposed that there was another point of view, because if that was the only point of view, why would he have to ask? So you could say that that's a machlokes. Moshe maintained that perhaps that position is wrong, and the other, there's another position, and that's why he had to inquire of God. Okay? Machlokes is the essence of Torah study, is machlokes. Yeah. So what is the proper conclusion from that? I think it would be a mistake to conclude from that the essence of Judaism is subjectivism. Machlokes presupposes objectivism. But instead, there's one objective truth. There's one presupposes that there is one objective truth. The only thing is that there are different, there's two opinions as to what that objective truth is, but each one is uncompromised. Each one maintains that his view is correct and the other one is false. If you study, that's very, very clear. If you just follow the derech of the great thinkers, and this is in the Gemara, and then beyond the Gemara, the Rishonim, who have tremendous respect for each other. I mean, that's one of the, we don't have that phenomenon anymore. I mean, that capacity, you know, for intellectual investigation and honesty and so forth. I mean, the Ramban, for example, has tremendous respect for Rashi, and so on. And Ibn Ezra, you know, you read them as well as Gedolos, and yet you see that he doesn't feel constrained, that he's bound to accept something because Rashi said it. Why? Because ultimately he's involved in a search for the truth. And when you're involved in a search for the truth, that's, I mean, people are important insofar as they have, you know, their opinions, authority, their opinions are important, or they may be bearers of information, you know, the masorah, they have a certain status, but ultimately the truth is more important. And you know, we don't maintain that something is true because this individual believes it. It's not part of Judaism. If something is true because a particular person maintained it. That is not the case with regard to anything in Judaism. that something is true because a certain person maintained it, it's true because it's true, or it's false. I mean, it's true. The truth has to stand on its own terms. And a person can never say, the only thing is, you can't argue with the Gemara, because these are the bearers of the Masorah. You know, they have information that was passed down from generation to generation to generation, so therefore the information that they have goes back to Sinai. So, in terms of fact, this way we accept the fact of the Torah, and then we begin to interpret. We accept the fact of the Torah as true because it comes from God. So that you can't argue with that. All we can do is try and understand it. Now, with regard to any particular person, you can say, "Well, Rashi, you know, we're having a discussion about an idea, and we work out it. We come to a certain logical conclusion." And then someone says, "Yeah, but Rabbi Hirsch disagreed and maintained differently, and he held it such and such." And then we analyze that view, and it doesn't make sense to us. We show that it's flawed. And we showed what our view was better. So, I mean, you can't say, well, it can't be. It has to be true, because Rabbi Hirsch said it. Rabbi Hirsch is a great man and all of that, but that's the fact that he believes something to be true does not make it true. That would have to be true with regard to anyone. With regard to anyone, there's no such thing in Judaism, because it just doesn't exist in reality, that something is true because a certain person maintained it true, unless you're dealing with an issue of authority. Where we have to accept it because he's a legitimate bearer of the Masorah. In that case, if it's Masorah, it's Masorah, accept it. But if not, then it's Yeshua ben Nun said it. I won't accept it because no person has that power. We don't believe in many people. We believe in ideas. Okay? Now, what is the idea? The idea, roughly, Elu ve'elu divrei Elokim ta'ala. What does that mean? That seems superficially to give the impression that there's many, equally true. There's only one truth. There's only one truth. Even if you can have it in a case, for example, in a machlokes, in a halachic machlokes, where if there are certain cases where we don't know the objective truth. You know, you can't, for example, an Eilu Kinchayim, both can't be true, because is something us or is something mutter. Let's say the Mosaic Mahalach Mahalach. It's going to boil down to a question, is this us or is it mutter? So what do you say? Eilu Eilu, and then we say Eilu Eilu. In both the truth, God says it's true that it's us, and it's true that it's mutter. And how could that be? Yeah, I mean, it can't be. There are many Mahalachim that you'll find that if you're going to say, it's an impossibility. They're mutually exclusive and incompatible. It's impossible that both should be true. Unless you want to admit the impossible. You can't say that. So therefore, what do you mean when you say able to able? It means to say that given the information that we have, given all the information, there are two expert logical explanations, right? Each one of which makes perfect sense within the system, and both are legitimate views within the system. In other words, Eilu ve'Eilu means that both have the status of being Torah. Because there's two areas of truth. There's objective truth, and then there's the... In other words, when God gave the Torah originally to Moshe, he didn't say, in this particular case, it's both Asher and Mutter. He didn't say that. Well, originally, if you trace back every machlokas originally, there wasn't a machlokas. There's only one idea. Now, over the years, machlokas developed because of whatever circumstances. But not every opinion is a valid opinion. A valid halachic opinion is only an expert opinion by someone who's qualified to make an opinion, who has all the information, and given all that information and his knowledge of how halacha works, leads to a logical explanation. It's a logical, valid explanation. See, that's in the same way this you could have in science also. In other words, you can have in certain areas all the information that we have lend themselves to two possible explanations, three possible explanations. But that's it. Then you argue up and back, you try and break down, until you say that, no, you can, there's no way you can break this position down, there's no way you can break that position down. Both are valid. But which one is true? You know, so now it becomes a different idea. In other words, so from the halachic standpoint, you're not in violation of the system. If you want to call that, that's the halachic truth. In other words, like if you have a valid poset, and you're going in accordance with his position, as opposed to another valid poset, so you can't say that what the other person is doing is wrong. You can't use the expression of your true and false anymore, because now you don't know which is true from the objective standpoint. But from the halachic standpoint, given that the system was given over to people, to human beings, and then all human beings are fallible, and over the course of time, arguments develop, so then we have to have a system for resolving it. In fact, originally, the reason why we have Sanei Machlosin is because we don't have the means of resolving it. When we had the system was functioning properly, we had the Sanhedrin, so ultimately all disputes were referred back to the Sanhedrin, and they'd be resolved, and that's it. There's only one halacha. Yeah, but the fact that even that doesn't mean it's the objective truth. You have the phenomenon of a Zakei Mamre, someone who's a great scholar who's fit to be on the Sanhedrin, and he argues with the Sanhedrin. So that he could, if he rebels, it's a rebellious elder, he could be put to death in certain areas. And then the Rambam says that once he had a dispute with the Sanhedrin, it went all the way through the Sanhedrin Agadol, and they passed him against him. And he has to be someone who's capable of Havra himself. Then he goes back to his town. So the Rambam is very interesting. He's allowed to teach his position. He's allowed to teach his view, as long as he makes it clear that it's not lahalach. He's from an intellectual point of view, he's not being stifled. Why? Because it's a valid point of view for limud, for understanding. And the truth is, it's possible he's right and they're wrong. We don't say that Sanhedrin operates by the majority. It's true, but truth doesn't operate by the majority. The majority could be wrong, the one individual could be right. But the halachic system, means that you go by the by God established the system so that. I mean, there's many stories that are brought down that even that indicate clearly, even if a person's position is the correct one, it doesn't mean that it's correct for halacha, because halacha operates according to it has to be a system. So that's the idea of iluv iluv. Iluv iluv dirim chachayim doesn't mean, though, does not mean to say that there's no objective truth. It just means to say that given our nature, human nature, and our limited capacities, we may not always be able to discover the absolute truth. So therefore we're struggling. Now, it doesn't mean also that every opinion is a valid opinion. That doesn't give a conservative rabbi the right to state his opinion. It means from an there is an element of objectivity over here too. From an objective standpoint, each opinion meets the criteria of a legitimate halachic opinion. So it's only a person, for example, like in medicine, treating a certain ailment. So there could be two schools of thought. So then you could say each one has a method of treatment, and you can't prove one above the other. It boils down to a matter of preference over here. But this methodology is legitimate, and that's legitimate. But you would say that. But what about medicine versus a voodoo? You know, like a voodoo doctor, right? That's not medicine. You say that's objectively speaking, that's not a physician. That's not valid. Okay, that's within the area of halacha. Now it seems to me that the same is really true with regard to areas of hashkafa. What is the hashkafa of Yadis? I mean, Yadis clearly contains, the element of the mitzvot, there's the halacha, then there's the question of what's the proper philosophy of life. God gave us a certain value system, a certain philosophy of life. Okay? So, it seems to me that clearly, Divrei Elokim Chayim, I mean, the Word of God. The Word of God is the truth. It's an objectively true system for everybody. The Torah is the objectively true system. It can't be, then, that there's many. You can't say that there's many ideas, each one is equally valid. It doesn't make any sense. It doesn't make any sense to say that. And great centers have to approach that area in the same way that you approach the area of halacha. You have to study very carefully, there's a certain methodology, and so on and so forth. But it seems to me, for example, when the Rambam wrote the Mora, which is an expression of the philosophy of Yad, according to him, so when he came to a certain conclusion, and when he was convinced this is the truth. I don't think he maintained that this is, for him it's true, and for others another derech is true. There's no other derech that's true. There's one correct derech, and the correct derech is to study the Torah. The Torah was given to us, was revealed to us. There's a derech on how to study, how to approach, how to study, what the methodology is. Now, the conclusions that you reach, will differ. I mean, that's in the nature of things. That's the nature of man. Not everybody's mind functions differently. Not everybody works identically. And you have great thinkers that will come to different. There is room for different opinions. I'm sure the Rambam would be certain other opinions that differ with his. He would respect and say, all right, but you know, I don't think the others he would negate. He would say they have no value at all. And you have to see. But what the idea is, though, that in Judaism you're really truly involved in a search for truth. If you're not involved in a search for truth, then you're not really studying Torah properly. The objective of Torah study is to discover the truth insofar as you're capable of doing so. Now, a wise person should know where he stands, should learn as much as he can, should know the proper derech, the proper methodology, know the effort that's required, and know who the authorities are, and so on and so forth. But what you're searching for, what you are searching for, after all is said and done, is for the truth. And if you should discover, something, you're totally convinced that it's the truth, then of course, I mean, it's got to be objective truth. It can't be not subjective truth. It's objective. It's the objective truth. I mean, anything which is different from that is false. I mean, I don't see what's wrong with that. That's not being egotistical or bigoted or anything like that. Let's take a look at the Rambam in the Mora. He speaks about what was the purpose of the Akedah. He says there were two purposes, and a secondary purpose was to establish the veracity of prophecy. Why would a man with an intelligent, rational individual would do the most distasteful thing to sacrifice his son and so on and so forth, which goes contrary to all human ideas of compassion and morality and so on and so forth, except because he's convinced it's the absolute will of God? I mean, from a subjective standpoint, he wouldn't have done it. But this is objective. This is real. This is what truth is. Okay. So, again, I'm saying that if a person views Judaism as being something separate than truth. In other words, when I'm going to school or in college, then I'm dealing in areas of truth. And Judaism is just a religion, that's complete falsification. I mean, Judaism is truth, that's a system of truth, and the whole purpose of Torah study is to discover the truth. This is the ultimate truth. The ultimate truth, and obviously that's why God revealed the Torah to us, because it contains the truth that man himself can't discover on his own. So that is the purpose of Torah study. The purpose of Torah study is not to just engage in a game, intellectual games, to up and back like a game of chess, just to go through certain moves. The objective is to arrive at the truth of Torah. That's an extremely important point. And I don't think that point is sufficiently appreciated. I think many people, it's just another exercise, well, I guess like that, unless they, you take the study up and back, you go through all the motions, and you never really arrive at any ideas. The purpose of Torah study is to arrive at ideas. Of course, each one on his level. And again, a person has to be smart just to know where his level is. I mean, if he goes beyond his level and he tries to write his own Moreh Nevuchim, then he's crazy. I mean, but that's true in any time. But in any time, the same thing will be true. A person has to know his level in medicine too. He's not going to come up with his own. Unfortunately, you see, it's the only area where you'll have it. In medicine, a person that really knows absolutely nothing in medicine can't start to write books on how to watch it. People are like, nuts. Oh, well, you do have a lot of that today, too. The voodoo stuff. It's become very alternative medicine. It's becoming more and more popular. Yeah, because the world is a little more subjective. Yeah, but any scientific person would realize he's crazy. I mean, who are you to have an opinion? The baby says this way, but I disagree. What do you know? You have to be a bucky, you have to be an expert in the field before you reach a level where you can even have an opinion. That's acceptable. Yet in Judaism, you find anybody and his two brothers can, due to the fact that people are so ignorant about the real ideas now, that people can be, you know, the Ram of the Marvukum is. Yes, an opinion. This guy has an opinion. Everybody, every local person, every local rabbi has his own opinion, his own philosophy, and so on and so forth. The person has to know his place. All right. The idea that the Torah is chachma and bina and das and knowledge, and therefore clear and rational. This is in the Rambam. The Rambam writes about this, and this is in the topic in the Torah that the nations will see. Well, what's the Pesach about? It's about them to be Chachmaschem li'enei hadayim. Chachmaschem li'enei hadayim. Hold it a second.
I know what it means.
This is what the Rambam says. This is your wisdom in the eyes of the Gayim, of the nations, that they will see the Chukim and the Shpatim, and they will say, Rak am Chacham v'Navon hagayah gadol hazeh. What a wise Chacham and Navon in discerning. Now, if that's not rationality, That's an amazing test. No religion can be put to this test. A religion which is purely subjective, which is mystical, which makes sense only to those people who already have faith in it, you have to be perfectly faithful like this. The Eni Hagayim, the Gayim don't believe in our system. Why would they say that it's wise, it's discerning? It means true Yad, this true Judaism is based upon ideas, objective ideas, rational ideas. That's why it's the Gayim. Because Gayim basically means people don't have the same emotional commitment from day one. Like, we're all born Jewish, so naturally we believe in Judaism. It means Gayim, and the Rambam says Chachmah Hagayim. Not biased people. Neutral people who are Chachamim, who will hear the true ideas of Torah, and they will acknowledge that this is true. That's why he says in his Hatzamat Perkeret. In the Hatzamat Perkeret, he says, therefore, when people have understandings and interpretations of Judaism, which are completely nonsensical, which are contrary to reason, he says that it's completely false. Because that is the test. That's any valid stuff has to meet this test. That it has to be something which is wise and hand-tying. Otherwise it's not Torah. Any idea, any philosophy of Torah, which does not meet the test of the Torah itself has given us this test, that is to say that Achmatzem Ubinachem Li'eni Ha'amim. It's positive. The fact that a person believes as an nonsensical system of religious beliefs, which is absolutely absurd and insane and nonsensical, does not necessarily mean that the person himself is totally irrational. The person could be a brilliant thinker in other areas. What does he have to know the nature of the human psyche? That in certain areas, people put aside their reason, okay, and they utilize different methods. They have very powerful emotional needs, and these emotions block out their reason. And that we know is one of the problems. In achieving intellectual perfection, you also have to achieve the ability to isolate emotions, which that's extremely important. Okay? So that's what I'm saying. In other words, all right, everybody agrees, in other words. There could be disagreements on that question too, within what constitutes logic. Of course, like anything else, you got to study logic. You got to study analysis, and I don't think there's any area of scientific thought where you won't have disagreement. But general agreement you'll have as to what constitutes scientific rational thought, logical thought, and so on and so forth. So I think what the Rambam is saying is that is the essence of Torah. It's chachma, that it meets the standards of logic. It's true, it's clear, it's demonstrable, a wise person, what a wise and discerning nation. The Chachma, who's going to say this? That means the greatest thinkers of the nation, if they hear the ideas presented properly, will come to this conclusion. So therefore, the Rambam is saying that is the idea, that is what Torah is. You follow? Now, therefore, you have to apply that test to any group that's going out there and proclaiming, you know, whether it's Chassidus, whether it's another group, and saying, this is the philosophy, this is what the Torah is talking about, this is what Chazal means. Whatever it is, if you think it over and you see that it's not rational, it doesn't withstand the test of rationality, it does not make sense, unless you already have a certain emotional predisposition. In other words, it makes sense to the Chassid because he already has that feeling. You see, he was raised and he has certain feelings. In other words, like this, there's two different kinds of explanations. There's explanations for the believers. For those who already believe, these are good explanations. But for the non-believers, they don't hit. Then there's explanations which make sense to any thinking person. What the Rambam is saying is that if you have an explanation which is only valid for the believers, like the last time you go with the tour, you can give a shalshus and the Rebbe will say a little verse, you know. It's nice because everybody accepts the premises and nobody questions. So you follow within that framework, nobody's asking the hard. Somebody would ask a little bit of a hard question, looks like, you know, he's a chutzpah. You've all had that experience. You just don't ask those kind of questions. You know, given certain parameters, it's Kedusha, and this is Kedusha, and every time you have Kedusha, you're creating something in the world, and then he works out a problem brilliantly, given certain premises. Well, that's not an objective exposition. That's an explanation for the believers, for those who already believe and don't ask the hard questions. You see what I'm saying? That's not what the Rambam is saying. The explanation that you give, if you want to explain the purpose of the Torah, the purpose of Tzitzis, so whatever it is you want to explain, that explanation must produce ideas, objective, universal ideas that any intelligent person who knows how to think is unbiased one way or the other will acknowledge that this is great chachma. Great, great chachma. And if you don't, if your explanation is one that won't make any impression, it's, you know, like, okay, if you believe in that, fine. You know, in other words, it's exactly the way you look at other people's religious beliefs. You know, these myths, the myths of Christianity and so on and so forth, you look at it like children believing in nonsense. Chas v'shalom to say the same thing about Torah. To me, it's very bothersome. When I go somewhere, by the way, I always have a problem. And a rabbi, whatever, anybody gets up to give a speech. You know, even if it's just for Jewish people, you know, it's the same as true. I mean, ordinary people that aren't necessarily learned, and you found, you know, like this is the philosophy of Judaism on a certain issue, and, you know, to me it makes, you know, no, it doesn't really make sense. It's really like mystical or childish or whatever. I mean, it doesn't really show the beauty of Torah. So I sort of cringe. It bothers me. And this is making Torah, you're degrading Torah in a sense, because you're making Torah like another non-practical system. This doesn't have any objective. This is the falsification of Torah. Torah is supposed to be the truth. This is the way any this is supposed to be the. Well, otherwise, we think God revealed the Torah, and it turns out that this Torah that God revealed, there's no difference. Any religious person, many religious, how is that possible? That person, there's many ways to God. This is good. The Christian, he believes his way. He believes his way. So why is God giving the Torah? To come to that point, that's what we mean. I mean, it's a denigration of God and God's Torah to say that this is. This is what it boils down to. These simplistic ideas that any primitive religious person could work out on his own. Well, where's the chachma? Where's the chachma? Everybody admits that Torah is a chachma. How can I call it a Talmud chacham? A person who learns Torah and knows he's called a Talmud chacham. Certainly in the area of halacha, a guy spent his life studying the Torah, he says it's tremendous, tremendous chachma. How much can I add about Tosfos Gresma? So why do you imagine that it's only limited to the halacha? To the study of Gemara. I mean, certainly in terms of the Derech HaChaim and the mitzvot and Talmud and mitzvot, it's a profound system of Chachma. And we can't even get to the bottom of that. Nobody claims that he can understand all the Torah. That's an impossibility. But whatever he manages to extract should have the element of being true Chachma. It's true Chachma. So how can it be if it's true chachma that it's like I feel this way, you feel that way? I mean, that only makes sense when you're not talking. Just from getting back to the very beginning, I mean, it's a matter of taste. All religions are essentially a matter of taste. I prefer this, you prefer that. That's how I feel. Makes me feel good. That's how people look at it. It's purely subjective. That's an enlightened person that's willing to admit that other people have a right to their feelings. But what the Torah itself claims that it is more. It's not that. I mean, more is not even a good word. It's something totally different. It's God's revelation. God's revelation is the truth. So therefore, when you seek to elucidate, it's got to be in terms of truth. It can't be in terms of mumbo jumbo that nobody knows what you're talking about. It's an open question that any presentation, any system is, in order to accept it, does it mean that once you understand it, you see the idea clearly, it makes sense, you'll accept it? It's an intellectual phenomenon? Or no, in order to accept it, you have to first have a certain feeling. You see a certain predisposition, you have to be won over. That's why a lot of groups try to win you over emotionally. And once you're won over emotionally, then there's two kinds of answers. Everybody needs an explanation, a body of belief. Because a body of belief that makes sense to someone who already accepts it. but does not make sense to someone who doesn't share the same feeling. So the true test is that these ideas make sense even without assuming those biased feelings. Those biased feelings. Everybody maintains that we know the chutzim, everything in the Torah is rational. There is nothing. What do you mean? There's something in the Torah which is not rational. It's the work of God. What do you mean? There's something in nature that's not rational. How can you say anything like that? I mean, the Ramban, everybody, all the Rishonim maintains that the chutzim, everything in the Torah is 100% rational. The only thing is, what they mean to say is that we have the capacity to see the rationality of it. We're limited. And even the Torah, is an expression of the infinite Chachma of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, so no one could be presumptuous and assume that he has the explanation for everything. But that's not the test. The Rambam didn't maintain that that is the test. The test is not that you have to show the reason for everything in the Torah. By the way, that's why he said, Chazal studied the reasons for the Tanya Mitzvah. And they said that Shlomo HaMelech was able to figure out the time of every mitzvah except for what? Paraduma. Well, that itself shows you that everyone has a reason. Right? That shows it's rational. It has a reason. And of course it's got to be a reason that makes sense. It can't be a crazy reason. It's defective. So therefore, that's what Chazal is saying. Okay? And we don't have these same capacities, and our capacity is, limited and so on and so forth, but everything in Torah is rational, and that it makes perfect sense. If you deny that, then it seems to me you cover and call it a Torah. How can you maintain that the Torah is the work of God? Would any individual maintain that nature is irrational? Everything is with Chachma. Shemayim is something about Kale. Everything works with Chachma. The more we study, the more we discover. There's points that we don't understand. We don't understand. But we know that it's Chachma. We know it's not crazy.
But there's a third category.
I told you before that I can't accept ideas. I cannot accept ideas just because another individual accepted them, even if he was the biggest Chachma in the world.
Okay, so
if those ideas themselves do not make sense. If those ideas do not make sense. Now, if you have a great, the Rambam, I respect the Rambam as a great, I think we all respect the Rambam as a great thinker. And he wrote the Mori Ruch. I mean, there's many things in the Mori Ruch, I don't understand what he's talking about. It's very hard to figure out what he's talking about. Okay? So, I mean, it could be that I just don't know what he's talking about. In which case, I don't say he's wrong. I realize that he's a much deeper thinker than I am, and I hope I can get bigger and be able to understand more. But in an area where it's clear what the person said, and I understand what he said, and that doesn't make any sense, and I come to the conclusion that it's irrational, so in my mind, it's what I'm supposed to go by. I have my mind. If I give up my mind, then I don't have anything.
Right, but that's,
and I don't have a mind, so then I don't know that I don't know anything.
But you still
have the question of whether rationality is the only approach, the only valid approach. I mean, well, let's put it differently. The question is, how does man arrive at any kind of conclusion? Does he arrive at the conclusion automatically, in some kind of a mystical fashion, somehow communicate him, or he arrives at it through a process of thought? That's the question. Let's forget about the word rationality. In order to arrive at a conclusion, at the truth, does man have to think, does he have to engage in thinking, or does he not have to engage in thinking? If you say that he doesn't have to engage in thinking, so then, then there's no need for rationality. Okay, but I don't think you would say that. If a person from any movement would tell you all the principles that he lives his life by, and you have to start to question them, and you say, well, that's the thing to question, that's just how I feel about it. I know that's it. You ask, well, how do you know? I just know, that's it. I have within me a certain innate knowledge of what to do, what's true.
So
you accept the tradition is true. Even if he accepts it on the basis of tradition, you have to go further and say, why? Is that because you think that which is traditional is right? And that's already a thought. That already involves a certain thinking, that even if he decides in his own mind, you see, he doesn't, and it has to involve thought because he doesn't. There are many areas where he doesn't go by the tradition. When a new medicine is discovered, so he doesn't go by the traditional way of treating it, he goes by the new way of treating it. So therefore he's involved in thinking. Now, if he's decided in this area that tradition is correct, it's because he's made a decision that tradition is correct. There's a force that goes behind that. And that thought is saying that since it's the tradition, it must be true, because that's what he thought. Right? It's based on a thought. No, other than that, I mean, or else he can tell me that that's a principle. Tradition is true. But that's already a thought. That's an idea. You can't just say tradition, because by tradition you're saying something. You're saying that in my, you know, in my philosophy of life, tradition, if it's the tradition, it has to be true. Oh, but is that subject? But that's not subject to being questioned. That has to be. Then that has to be subject to question. Well, maybe it's true, maybe it's not. So I think that either you're acknowledging that man can only arrive at the truth through thought, or you're saying that there's some other mechanism. That's the way the question is framed. Now, I maintain that man can only arrive at the truth through thought. There are certain things, there's other seven, obviously the term of Sinai, you know, is witnessed by the senses. I'm not negating sense perception. Of course. Of course they involve thought. But I mean, sense perception, through sense perception a person can acquire knowledge of physical reality. Okay. But I mean, when you're saying that, a person acknowledges, once there's no sense perception, you're saying that I don't need to know the truth. The truth is something that I have to acquire. I have to acquire through a certain process. Okay? Now, essentially, of course, beyond simply what can be seen, I mean, the interpretation and so on and so forth is in the realm of thought. Now, then the question is, if a person has to operate with thought, that's the only way that he can say knowledge. So, is there a proper method of thinking? Is there an improper method of thinking? I think that everybody in the universe, from day one, anyone that's been involved in the area will say, of course, there's a proper method of thinking, and there's an improper method of thinking. So therefore, and each person will say that he's striving for the most proper method of thinking. And I think that within the field, they all have to do it with or rational. Rational means it's correct, it makes sense, it's self and so on and so forth. That's what you mean when you say it's rational. And you use this term in every other area of your life, when in business or your wife comes up with a plan and you think it over, you say it's totally irrational. You need to say that it's not logical, it's not correct thinking. So a person recognizes that, and therefore he will recognize in any other area where it's a matter of knowledge, where it's a matter of knowing what's the best way, is that the irrational approach, and if you know what to use that word, then use that word. An approach of good, correct thinking is the best approach. And if you know of an alternative approach, if there is an alternative approach to thinking, let me know about it. And if it's better than the so-called rational approach, then we'll certainly accept it. So if a person claims that the rational approach, Torah, is the only approach to Torah, how can anybody contest such a thing? I mean, when Moshe writes a psak, you know, what is an underlying idea? I mean, that's the best of his knowledge. I mean, he's very humble, so he doesn't claim that he can't make mistakes. That's something else. But I mean, to the best of, insofar as he's a posek, and he maintains that he's correct, he's saying that what I just did is totally logical, because I went to the correct sources, I understood them correctly, I interpreted them correctly, and I applied them to the case correctly, and this is the correct conclusion. I mean, it's like a scientific thing. So what he's saying is, he's not using those words necessarily. That's my interpretation of what any posek, anyone who writes a book and he comes to certain conclusions, he's maintaining that this is correct. That my idea is correct. And I assume that he's arrived at it through the process of thinking. So it's correct thinking. Now when you analyze it, you see that you said A, and you said A automatically leads to B, but I can show you that it doesn't. So that's what you have in the question. But I can't ask that question if you're going to say that's not how I arrived at my conclusion. I didn't. I arrived at my conclusion through some other mechanism which you can't even relate to. I like to have some innate power. God has endowed me with a gift, so that whatever my mind comes up with, that's the truth. Now, if a person takes that approach, then of course I can't criticize him by saying it's illogical, because he's saying that logic is not the issue. So you have to decide what do you think should be the approach? Do you What you're doing is, are you empowering individuals? You're saying that these individuals are different than the rest of us, and they just have some innate ability to know what's true and what's false. Well, I know that the only difference between people is that some people are more perfected in the science, in the art and science of thinking. And I mean, yeah, that's very, very clear that we don't endow people, there's no skin of people. And Talmud Chacham is one who studied Torah and has reached a certain level. I mean, well, then there's different levels, you get sneaker, then there's higher levels of sneaker, and so on and so forth. And there's no such thing as an individual who is innately endowed with knowledge of what is true and what is false and doesn't have to think. The whole value of Judaism is Talmud Torah. Talmud Torah means you have to study. The more you study, the whole Chazal. From Sarazah, the more you study, the more you work on it, the more you perfect yourself, perfecting the mind. I mean, what's all that's necessary is what? What is the purpose of trying to perfect the mind? It's because we assume that there is a objectively correct method of thinking. And the more a person, man is fallible, I mean, but the more a person achieves this, so the more apt his ideas are to make sense and so on and so forth. So what other way is there? In reality, what other way is there? It's not just Torah is one particular area, but in any other area. If you're going to say that the rational way is not the only way in Torah, then you say the same thing in medicine, you say the same thing in anything. Why do you limit this just to the realm of Torah? Why don't you live your whole life that way? By the non-rational way. If that's the way you're setting it up. If you're setting it up as the rational way versus the non-rational way, so why is it only in Torah that you choose the non-rational way? Why do you choose to be non-rational in every area of your life? Run your business in the non-rational way. I just don't understand it. I don't see how anybody can contest this. I don't see what the argument is. Because in the only process other than thought that the Torah recognizes is Nevuah. There is a phenomenon of Nevuah that God communicates. Although even Nevuah, the Rambam's interpretation of Nevuah is not so simple, but God doesn't communicate to anyone. That's a person who's perfected in every area, in every faculty, and logically perfected, and so on and so forth. But that's not important for this discussion. What do you view to be the qualifications of the Nevi? But no matter what, even if you should say that a Nevi doesn't require the qualifications, you should say that I know this to be true, not because of knowledge, but because God communicated it to me. Then, of course, it has to be tested whether it's Nevuah or not. See? So, in other words, that's something else. If someone were to claim that a certain individual is Mashiach, this is not the way it's going to happen, but it's not according to the Rambam. It's not going to be established in Nevuah. According to the Rambam, the identity of the Mashiach will not be established in Nevuah. So let's assume someone wants to do so. Now I know he's Mashiach. How do you know? Prove it. God, I need proof. I have knowledge because God communicated in Nevuah. Okay? So then, if he could test the test and prove conclusively that he's a Nevi, so then you have something. But obviously we don't have, that's not part of our discussion, because no one is claiming today, I don't think, that his interpretation of Judaism is true because it's based on Nevuah. And that type of thing is not given over to Nevuah. Okay. Nevuah is not issued for the sake of the halacha, asking what the halacha is, or for the sake of saying what the interpretation is. I don't think anyone has made that claim. So therefore, we have no choice. I don't think this is comforting to people. If people want something, again, it just makes people feel insecure. So now I have to think. And people want to live in a world of simple absolute. Simple and absolute. That's what Christianity is all about. They want to have these childlike beliefs that this is the truth, and that's it. Now, you want to believe that this is your Rebbe, you follow what he tells you to do. Not only with regard to Torah, but even with regard to all areas of your life. It's not even part of Torah that whether you should go into this business, not business. Even they lord, all the stories lord the Rebbe, not for their expertise in Torah, but for their uncanny knowledge in business. Whether you should invest in money, you shouldn't do that. Virtually to have an individual. I don't see where that comes from. Well, to have an individual to whom you can submit every issue of your life. So, I mean, what you see from that, whether it's right or whether it's wrong to do so, what you see from that is that they want simple ethics. They want to be free from the obligation of having to finish, and to therefore be able to put all their trust in someone else, in a person. Of course, in my opinion, that's wrong, and there's a big danger in doing that. So we'll forget about that for the moment, but doesn't that show you that that's really what they want? Now, when you start to question, now people like that are going to get very upset. If they say, well, I'm doing it, why are you starting to do this? Because the Rebbe told me to do it. But why did he tell you to do it? The market conditions? The Rebbe. Now, if you start to say, but look and analyze this logically. I mean, he's just another person, so maybe he's an insightful person, but let's go to the answer. That person's going to get very upset with you because you're now undermining the principles upon which he bases his security. Just to continue along these lines a bit, I think that is the key point. If we maintain that Yahadus is a truth, there's a truth there, we're just using that term truth, is basically a form of knowledge, if it's either it's knowledge or it's not. If it's knowledge, so then we have to use the methods by which we obtain knowledge in any area. And I think everybody agrees that it's knowledge. And Talmud can make it true. I don't think anyone denies. Nobody denies the primacy of Talmud Torah. And what's the purpose of studying the Torah? If the methodologies of study and obtaining knowledge are not applicable. I mean, clearly, you can't argue with anything like this. That the Torah is a body of knowledge. And if that's the case, then we have to use the methodologies that a person uses in every seeking knowledge in any area. It's absurd to imagine that such a discussion would occur with regard to medicine. That there's a different approach in medicine. Or in engineering. But when we talk about different approaches, we mean specifics. We're talking about particulars. Because within, given the phenomena, a scientific person can, there's many possibilities. Since we don't know all of the possibilities, then there's room for different approaches, but each approach claims to be in line with the reality of the situation. That's what truth means. Truth means corresponding to reality. And we all agree that the only methods that we have to know what corresponds to reality are scientific methods, whether it is it's logical or it's trial, if it meets the test, experimentation, and so on and so forth. And not everything is always subject to experimentation, so you have to use whatever logical tools are available. So no one's going to have this, but the point is, I don't think anybody's going to maintain that there's a rational approach and then there's an irrational approach. There'll be an absurdity. Unless you have somebody who's claiming to have powers that we're not aware of, superhuman powers. And there are people like that. There are charlatans that claim that they have special, they have sorcery, magicians and so forth, palm readers, that claim that they have access to knowledge of events that the ordinary person does not have access to using the ordinary tools of scientific thinking. So that the Torah itself forbids us to consult with these individuals. So, therefore, I don't see how anybody can maintain that there is another approach in that general sense. Specifics, of course. Developing a methodology to deal with a particular subject, that is there's room for discussion, debate. There's different approaches. I mean, every scholar is not going to approach the matter, the subject matter. That's the nature of the area. It's vast. So how do you specifically approach an area in terms of like the Chumash or opening up a Gemara? There's different approaches, if that's what you mean, but each one is going to have to pass the test of rationality. Now, if you can demonstrate that what the person is doing doesn't make sense, it's not logical, so then there's a serious problem there, and one shouldn't accept it. You're not on a level where you can understand what he's doing, so I'm not talking about that. I'm assuming you have to use your mind. If it's clear, if it's clear to human reason that this approach makes no sense, then it can't be the truth. It can't be true in terms of Torah. I thought it's the prophet. God is telling you this is what the Torah is. The system of Chachma and Bina. If we're a different kind of a system, it's really Loba Shemayim and so on and so forth. I mean, if it was a different kind of a system, then perhaps you could say that the rules of ordinary reason don't apply. But God is telling us that this is your wisdom and your discernment in the eyes of the nation. And that is to say, in the eyes of people. And it's not most religious people. You know, when they proclaim their doctrines and it doesn't make sense to the ordinary mortal, so they say, yeah, because it's not something that man can really grasp, it's a divine truth that only angels can understand. So you can't subject it to the test of human reason. It makes sense, but it's not something that humans can understand. Alright, so then, you know, people accept that. Now, I'm not contesting whether that, you know, the Torah could be or could not be of that type of category, but it's not, because the Torah is ki chachmasem uvinasem the ene hagayim. Well, the ene hagayim is part of the modification in the eyes of the Gentiles. The Gentiles simply mean, as I understand it, why the Gentiles? Why not in the eyes of the Jews? The eyes of the Gentiles mean the unbiased people. It means a person who does not have any particular act to drive. He's not either committed to or committed against. So that it makes perfect sense to any person who's using his reason. He's using his reason, following it will be convinced of the truth. So as I said, if that's the case, it's a system of truth, then you have to use the categories of knowledge. Now we're not arguing about the categories of knowledge. So that's what the idea that this is the only approach. And, the person that attacks, let's say, our approach on the basis that it's a rational approach, it's reason, and so on and so forth, and says that this is not the correct way, I mean, it's an assault to me, it's an assault on Torah. I don't know. You don't have to agree with any the specific explanations you don't have to agree with. No one ever claims that this is the only explanation. I mean, anyone who claims such a thing, that his shot, the skittish, or his interpretation of the only correct one, and that's arrogance. That's total arrogance. So I don't know anyone that's making such a claim. But to say that there is a different approach which is not based upon reason and logic and knowledge, and it's based upon some type of a deep mystical feeling that people have, and that's how they arrive at their conclusions, to me, I say that's sheker and that's fear. That's not Torah. Whatever that person. And in that person where he's denying Torah, he's elevating himself. He's elevating himself because that's the whole basis of Torah is that we ourselves do not have the innate. Why did God reveal to us the Torah? We don't have any innate sense of what's right and what's wrong. By the way, a lot of philosophers, I think Kant maintained that, the moral law within you. That's a lot of people maintain that, that the person simply follows his conscience. Somehow or other, he has innately an understanding of what's right and what's wrong. We say that's total shekel. That's really the truth. I don't know how anybody. You take a look at the world around you, and you see different societies. You understand a little bit of psychology. You see how every people under the flare of conscience can commit the worst atrocities. So conscience in and of itself is not any guide. Is not specifically a guide to the truth. There is a role. Conscience does play an important role. According to the Torah, explains to us what role it should play. So we don't maintain that. So therefore we maintain that the truth is something that man can only arrive at by the use of his faculty of reason. However, God revealed to us the specifics, the data, the Torah. So in other words, man on his own without the revelation, God's revelation, was a very tough time, if possible at all. I mean, I'm not going to take up that issue, whether man can come to these conclusions. In other words, the great Jewish philosophers like Isaac Gaon, for example, maintain that since the Torah is rational, then the human mind, operating rationally, perfected human mind, could come to these same conclusions. Coming to him with the question, so why did God have to reveal the Torah? Since since it's rational and human rationality could arrive at it. And the great philosophers, who understood the true nature of Torah, that it is rational, for them the question is, why was there a necessity for revelation? Alright. So whatever the case is, God did reveal to us. But this revelation is something, again, this revelation is something that does not come to us in a form where all these, you know, all the answers are just given. You know, you just press a button and the answers come out. It's something which it's studied properly. In other words, the data, God revealed to us the basic data, the information, and so on and so forth. But to really, truly understand it, that's where our own activity comes into the picture. We have to apply our minds to the study of Torah. And if we do so properly, of course, using the methodology of Torah, obviously, has its own methodology. That you understand, there's a methodology in Torah. But that is, in other words, that is, we use proper methodology, and we use seichel and reason and so forth, then you're on the right track. I don't think anybody can contest that. I think that people that do this are really harming Klal Yisrael. They're distracting, they're taking people away from the pursuit of Torah knowledge, and they're encouraging them to engage in other pursuits, which is contrary to Torah. And that's the way I would look at such a thing. A person can be told from two different ways. Deny the rationality of Torah. The Torah is truth. You're denying the character of Torah. You may say it's from God, but but it's another form. It's still form denial. You're being machshish to Torah. The whole theology. Torah is Hashem Tamimam, Shivas Nefesh, Eidus Hashem Nehemiah. What's Machkimas Pesach? What is it in Machkimas Pesach? Machkimas Pesach. It makes wise the Pesach, like a fool. It makes wise the fool. I interpret that. I say that Torah is more than just a system of knowledge. But there's a whole, the only system which is constructed in such a way that it really trains the mind. Say a person, see, there's no other system that does that. In other words, you've got one of the critiques of college today, the secular schools, is that it doesn't really train you to think. So if you have a very good mind, you know, you think on your own more or less, then you can operate. But they don't have a system to train you for. A lot of people today don't know how to think properly. They're not taught how to think. They really can't teach a person how to think. But the Torah is more like the Gemara is worked out in such a way that it forces you. See, it incorporates within it all the different forms of logical reasoning in order to, you see, it's like you can't teach a person to swim by telling them all this. You got to get in the water and you got to work. But you don't have a system where the system itself is designed to force you to make all the proper moves and to refine your thinking abilities and so on and so forth. So that's machkima spesi. It's more than just a system of ideas, but it's constructed in such a way that it's the best pedagogical tool. It trains you how to think. So therefore, someone who regards himself as being ignorant, untutored, if he applies himself to the study of Torah, he'll become a chacham. He'll become a chacham. That makes you into a chacham. That's an additional advantage. That's an additional advantage that which you don't find in any other system. The best training that's not the purpose. It's just an additional benefit. The purpose of studying the Torah is not to train the mind. So you see, I don't want to be a big scientist. It's to be involved, of course, in the knowledge of the ideas of the Gemara. Yeah, but it's an additional benefit in that it's constructed in such a way that it trains the mind. There's no other system like it. If a person wants to, I'm saying that this is the wrong motivation and it shouldn't be used that way. But I'm just saying it to illustrate a point that even if people did not believe in Torah, so to speak, and I'm only saying this to illustrate the point, and they wanted to send their kids to a school where they'd be trained how to think logically and sharply and precisely and so on and so forth, then there'd be nothing better than the study of Gemara, even if they didn't believe in Gemara. Even if they didn't believe these things and the conclusions are based upon true ideas. But just the methodology itself, the way it's constructed, where you produce individuals who are logical thinkers. And, like I said many times, that's why a person shouldn't get discouraged if he feels he's not that bright or he's not that sharp. He feels that he's like a peasant. Yeah, but the Torah guarantees you that's simply because you haven't subjected yourself to the training process. If you are subjected to the proper training process, you become a chacham. We propose that everybody can be a chacham in that sense. Now, at what level? There's different levels. How great a talmud chacham, but nobody really knows. A person shouldn't put himself down. That's why, especially at this age, it's really absurd. Like, who's the best? Or, you know, people rate themselves. I say you don't really know. Because he didn't really, nobody has really subjected himself to that type of an effort over a sustained period of time. You have no idea. If you did, then you could say, more or less, you could have a sense of what your level is. But most people judge themselves before they really subject themselves to the process. But you got to do so in a very strenuous kind of a way. But at any level that you study Torah, it's machkim asesi. It's in the very character of Torah that it's machkim asesi. All this goes to show that it's chachma. Machkim asesi, it's chachma. And what do you mean machkim asesi? In what? In being a mystic? It makes you, it perfects you. It's telling you what the Torah does. It makes you perfect. In what? And the ability to go into a trance and come up with anything that appeals to your any religious notion that appeals to your imagination, and then to sort of like rationalize it into sukkim where it doesn't really fit, and to use all kinds of ingenious methods to twist around and distort the plain meaning of the text in order to, you know, to back up your nonsensical idea. That's machkim asefi. The Torah is chachma. If you hear somebody expounding, giving an idea, explaining his philosophy or the others, whatever it is, it's got to be chachma. It's got to meet the test of chachma. Okay, if it doesn't meet the test of chachma, then there's a problem. You ask the question. I mean, if something matters, if this person is claiming that what he's saying is rational and he's explaining it, and he just, you know, you're incapable of understanding it because it's too deep for you, so then there's something else. So it's too deep for you. But I mean, it's not too deep for you. You hear what he's saying. You see what he's saying. It just doesn't make sense. He's trying to insist that this is the way it has to be because he's using, like when it comes to religion, there's a different type of thinking that everybody, you know, everybody sort of agrees will use. Then there's a problem. In other words, in my opinion, again, if you just maintain the Torah, the Torah is essentially just another religion, and it's not really knowable. It's not intelligible and rational, which is definitely happens to be the true religion. But it's just another religion. And the ideas of Torah, again, you know, have to appeal, like any religion, it has to appeal to certain, you have to feel it. You feel it. When you feel it, you'll get it. You know, and that's basically what they're saying. A person can't justify his ideas objectively and rationally, so then it boils down to that. Well, you know, you just have to work on getting that feeling. The whole idea of all religious movements. You know, they create a certain emotion, a certain, there's different ways of doing it. In order to create a certain feeling. And you feel it, you get it. That's the Gentile idea, you know, like you're born again. All of a sudden the feeling comes over you, and now all these things just made absolutely no sense to you when you were sober, and when you were using your mind. So this question arose in the, I was astounded. In the court in the high school, in Rambam. I don't know how I was discussing the concept of Moshe Rabbeinu, where he saves the daughters of Yisrael from the Rohan. Then it says by Yashkes Hatzom, and he watered their sheep. Separate point, in other words, everything we do is based upon the idea that we are these creatures that we have our existence only because of the will of God.
Right.
The starting point of everything.
Right.
You need to say, I'm not going to speculate now. Let's say that we're not the case. Obviously not. Any other alternative is impossible. But if you want to be like a sci-fi kind of thing, if man existed as the many atheists claim that there is no God, in that framework, well, it is relevant because according to them, so what's their basis for any kind of morality? Like if it's correct, you'd be a moral atheist. Right. Except for this question, which I'm not going into right now. That's not the point. The question was raised, though. I raised the question many times that justice, Moshe operated from the standpoint of justice, so therefore I understand why he saved the girls from the relics. So why did he have to go ahead and water the sheep? That doesn't seem, I mean, when you read it, it doesn't strike you because it seems like he did a nice thing. But if you analyze logically, that's superfluous. That was their job. I mean, when Moshe operated with reason, with seichel, so why would he do it? And the deed, it seems, was complete when he actually saved them. I give the example. I mean, if you stop off on the way to work and you see someone's breaking into someone's house, you know, a woman is screaming, and you do a heroic deed, you get out of the car and you confront the criminals and you drive them away, so you save the woman. So the story ends at that point. Then you, you know, you calm her down. And then what do you do? Then you're saying, I'm going to do your housework for you too? It doesn't make sense. There's no need. They didn't... On the way to work. Someone's confronted by a burglar. So you say, so then what do you do? Now I'm going to go in and do your work for you too? That's the perfect analogy. They didn't have any problem with the activity itself. They were capable of doing the work. So why do you have to now go and warn the sheep? I wanted to say that really it was connected to justice. It wasn't just Tom that Moshe wanted to be a nice guy. Because, you know, everything has to be based. That's not being a nice guy. Doing somebody, in fact, that's not nice. So then go around, spend your whole time doing other people's jobs. It's not, there's nothing nice about that. In fact, it may even be harmful. People are supposed to do their own job. Unless there's a reason. That you know, there's got to be some cause. The person needs help, so then you're involved in an activity of justice. It's just time to do things for people where there's no real need. I don't know if there's any point in that. Now, I would say like this, that there are two elements in justice. Justice really means to right the wrong. Now, when a person oppresses another person, there are two consequences. One is the objective. One is the objective framework. In other words, an injustice is just a theft of property. It's an economic law. So justice is to restore the law. But then there's another law. In other words, on a personal level, when a person is the victim of an injustice, it's an affront to his sense of dignity as a human being, a personal affront. So a person suffers on two different levels. And anyone that's been subjected to it will recognize that if your car is broken into. And it's one thing, the damage. The damage can be minimal, but there's a certain blow. A certain blow to your own sense of security, but also dignity. A person's mistreated. You can't tolerate the idea of being mistreated. You know, a person is cheated in business, as a worker, and he feels he was cheated on his salary, or whatever the case is. It's a blow to his dignity. It's not necessarily, even that's not necessarily with security, but it's a blow to his dignity. That's what he can't tolerate. So you see that people, it's a marvel, you see that people can't tolerate being cheated. Like, the person, like he's driving home from the store, he's gone shopping, and then he discovers that they made a mistake and they overcharged. Well, there's supposed to be a sale, and he assumed that he was getting the sale price, and he turned out they gave him, you know, they're charging the regular price. So the amount can be minimal, but the person will spend hours and hours rectifying it, much, much more than it's worth in terms of monetary. The person will go out of his way, because he can't tolerate the idea that he was made a fool out of. And it's fun to his dignity. Yes, and I was saying that's into the punch of Tzedek Tzedek. Now, I always thought about that. It's a repetition. Tzedek Tzedek. But Tzedek Tzedek means there's two levels of Tzedek. One is the objective, and one is with regard to the person. The sensitivity. In other words, sensitivity to the personal feeling. You see also, by the way, you see in Shiva, that if you oppress another person, if you commit an injustice to another person, let's say you cheat him out of money, so it's not enough just to replace the money. What do you have to do? You have to inspire him. You have to pacify the person. You have to go and pacify him, apologize to him, and ask for mechila. If it's simply an issue of objective harm, so you've restored the money. The answer is that there was more than that. Your deeds entail much more than that. There's a certain blow, right? You put a certain harm to this person, and it's like a logical sense, and that has to be restored. So Moshe Rabbeinu was involved in tzedek and pursuing justice on the highest possible level. So, in terms of the objective, he drove off the shepherd. So that was corrected. See? But that wasn't anything personal for that. That didn't show any specific concern about them as individuals, because that's simply objective society. It doesn't mean policemen. A policeman rescues you. He's not doing it for you. It doesn't mean anything specifically for you. It's just for society. We can't tolerate this in society. So had Moshe just driven them off, that would have solved the practical problem. But we can't, you know, we can't allow people to push other people around. There's got to be an order. But it's not personal for them. Because Moshe didn't realize that when this happened, there was a blow to them personally. They wanted to do something specifically for them to increase their own self-esteem, to restore the wound that their self-esteem, you see, their dignity had suffered. That's why he wore the sheep. That's specifically for them. That's not for society, okay? That's specifically for them. That was the level that Moshe Rabbeinu operated on. That wasn't just something I guess. But it was a calculation. That's the highest level of justice. Then later on, you see, Israel recognized the level of Moshe Rabbeinu just from the instant. So it takes a chacham to be able to recognize what another chacham is doing. Because when Moshe, when the girls came back then, they came back, so they came back early. Because Moshe did the work for them, and then they came home. So Yisrael asked them, how come, Mihat and Lovelay, why are you home so early today? So they said that Ishmitri, Ishilonim Yadarolim, Vagam Dolo Dolo Lano, Vagam. And he also drew water for them. Vayashka Satan, and he wore the Yashiv. So then Yisrael said there was a Vahaya. There was a little rebuke over there. He rebuked them. So he rebuked them, Vahaya. What is this? How did you just leave the man go? How did you obey him? Kilen lo v'yokha lechem. Go on, give him an imitation and let him eat bread. So Rashi says that lechem is a euphemism for isha. Because it says by Yosef, it's v'lo yada ito ma'uma, kiyem es ha'lechem asher okeh. Except the lechem. Except the bread. In other words, that Yosef had assumed total control over the affairs of Potiphar, and he didn't supervise him at all, except for the bread. That he ate. Which means, in other words, other than he had nothing to do with anything except for the fact that his meal. But Rashi says that lechem is a euphemism for isha.
How is that supposed to matter?
How can you deduce it in the words of Yisrael? In the case of Yosef, right? Then the Torah chose that word. Yimas alechem. That's the Torah, that's narrative, that's not dialogue. In other words, when the Torah is describing a story, so it uses a term, it didn't have to use the term lechem. It could have said ochel, whatever. I mean, it could have used any kind of wanted term. The Torah wanted to describe that he had complete control over everything, except for his own specific bodily needs, basically. That's it. But the question is that when the Torah uses the term, then you can say that it has many different levels of interpretation. Right? And it's a euphemism referring to his wife, Isha. But in the case of Yisrael, it's just an ordinary conversation that Yisrael had. So how can you attribute that to Yisrael? Well, Yisrael had that in mind. Rashi's based himself on the idea that the word lechem clearly is a reference to Isha. Does that mean an ordinary human conversation when I use the word bread? So then. The question would be, Max's question would be, like, if you're recording a conversation, and I said, look, come on, we'll break bread together, right? And then you'll say, well, therefore I'm referring not just to bread, but I'm referring also to maybe we'll get a Mashiach. How can you say that? How do you know that I'm just using the word bread now, Paul? You see, the fact that the Torah chooses that word, and the Torah, according to the Torah, it implies more, is one thing, but here you're recording a conversation that Yisro had. So how can you say that that's a reference to Isha? Let's put it this way. It doesn't mean to say that whenever the term lechem is used, it has connotation. It's not a code word. Like Ben pointed out in the case of Yisro, the case of Moshe lechem lechem, and it doesn't mean Ben is obviously correct, but it doesn't obviously, so it doesn't always mean that, but it can mean that. In other words, the term has deeper connotation, and that's what they explain why. But why the Torah decided to just make it up by arbitrarily? There's a connotation over there. So there is a connection between the two, which makes sense if we could discover. Now the only thing is that when the Torah uses that word by Yisrael, we could see from the entire context that Yisrael was interested in more. That's what the Rashi is pointing out, and that is that. verified by the term lechem. In other words, if you just had the word lechem alone, obviously you wouldn't say that's what he was talking about. And you couldn't do that, because the term lechem alone doesn't mean... At that point in time, Kerem Lo V'yochal Lechem, then he comes and it should be very simple that he's reducing them because of Hakaras HaTov. In other words, the person doesn't eat steak like that to you, so you, how do you let him go? You have to compensate, you have to demonstrate your Hakaras HaTov, invite him for a meal. Had Moshe then come, had the meal, and then left, then nobody would have said that Lechem had that implication. You see? But it is possible that Lechem does have such an implication. So therefore, when Rashi and Chazal studied the whole area, and they saw that one thing led to another, that Yisrael, and they understood the nature of Yisrael and the relationship that subsequently developed, you see that Yisrael was involved. I explained one time that he was really involved in love. Today is a big mitzvah to marry a daughter for Talmud Chacham, and that it becomes evident. So therefore, even in the term Lechem, he was suggesting to them. Because that's how they were high level people, and they spoke that way, and the term had different implications. So he was already expressing on a certain level his recognition that this is the type of quality that you should look for. In other words, a secondary idea. Aside from that, he's saying, he had seven daughters. You're looking for a shidduch. That was like on a different level, on a subterranean level, and you should also aside from your chiyuv, you should recognize that a person that acts in such a way is an extremely perfected individual. And who knows? That's the lowest thought factor. Zala pointing out two things over here. They're pointing out something about marriage and the type of qualities that a person should really be concerned about when they're looking for shidduch. And they're also pointing out something about the nature of Yisrael. But Yisrael recognized something about Moshe. Okay? Now, let me just finish this one. So now, just the last issue I want to bring up over here is, it seems that there was a bit of a rebuke. Lomaza is up to the Ayo. So then the question is, so why didn't the daughter invite him? It seems to be elementary. It doesn't seem to be like, that doesn't seem to be an advanced thing. If a person does a thing like that, out of the blue, a total stranger, who has no need to get involved in the case, doesn't concern him at all. When he's a stranger, it's mystery, they say. It's not even my place. But usually if you're an outsider, you don't start up with the locals. And he's one person against all of them. He puts himself at tremendous risk to save strangers. Then he continues, and not only does he do that, but then he waters all their sheep, which is a big job, and they get them early. And you don't even, and it's a question of the daughters, and you see that there has to be high level people, because then Tzipora, or she married Tzipora, she was, has to be a big tzaddikah. She was a big tzaddikah. So I say like this, that means to say, I say like this, this is my interpretation, that the rebuke, that why didn't they invite him? I would say that apparently these girls are very modest. And of course they thanked him. The Torah doesn't have to record every particular. Of course they thanked him. But since they were modest, they may have felt it's inappropriate to go one step to become bold. You see? And also they too could have had this idea of Lecha, that he'd make an ideal Ashidah, possible to say that. But they were modest. And they weren't aggressive, so they thought it would be bold of them to invite him to come to the house. So therefore Yisrael was rebuking them by saying that even modesty, everything has to be under the control of the sex. You can't just operate under emotions. There's a time and place for modesty, and there's a time and place when you have to be aggressive. In this situation, you see, Lama Zah is after the fish. See, you were too modest in the sense that you were following your emotion of modesty, where it was inappropriate. And no emotion in and of itself is virtuous. It always has to be with Seichel. So the here, Seichel demanded that you should be more active. So that was the thing. In other words, their failure to do wasn't the lack of appreciation, it was simply because they were too modest. So Yisrael was rebuking them and telling them that modesty per se is not the ideal, but you have to use a seichel. In this situation, logic demands that you invite them in for a meal.